Hello, friends. Chris here, your editor and sometimes host of Thaka with Advantage. I just wanted to let you know that we now have a Patreon for the show. You can find it at patreon.com, THAC0WA. That's patreon.com/THAC0WA. Now, we got one level for this Patreon. It's $5. And for that, you'll get access to our Patreon Discord channel to talk with us, at least bi-weekly PDF releases, which will include one of the following: some new spells, we're working on alternate spellbook, a Heroes of Havel's Way PDF, including setting material, game design stuff, and things like that, and potentially other game design systems and thoughts from myself, Jared, or Ange, or maybe even some guest creators once we have a few bucks. You'll also get a bonus podcast called Chris's Havel. This is a podcast of my GM thoughts on episodes of Heroes of Havel's Way. By the way, the Heroes of Havel's Way is a new actual play series that we are making, me, Ange, and Jared, that's 5th edition inspired. There will also be a monthly Discord hangout with myself and potentially Jared and Ange, and you'll get a shout out on the show. Furthermore, this is really just to help us make Thaka with Advantage. I try really hard to make sure that the edit and mix on this show sounds as good as humanly possible, and the Patreon will help pay for that and for Ange and Jared's time. Well, with that, thank you for listening, and let's get on with the show.
And now we present to you Thaka with Advantage.
Hi, I'm Ange, and I've been gaming for over 3 decades. A decade ago, I started writing for Gnome Stew, and eventually I started running the podcast, The Gnomecast. And at some point, they made me head gnome in charge of all of the things. So, if you have any complaints, I'll be hiding in the stew pot.
And I'm Jared, the review gnome at Gnome Stew, and I've lost a decade or so of time in the last 3 weeks, so I barely know where I'm at. In addition to writing reviews at Gnome Stew, I've got my own site, whatdoinojr.com, where I write additional reviews and opinion pieces on a variety of RPGs.
After we look at the games we're running in the campaign journal, we'll be talking about virtual tabletops and some of our current thoughts about them. Then we'll have some recommendations of D&D-related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment.
Now stand by for station identification. This is WDND The Role Player. Now we're going to McElroy McKinney and the Bardic College.
Cast the Betrayer is essentially Schrodinger's henchman. That's a Schrodinger cat reference for those who don't know. It's always there, even though the box is open or not. Anyways, depending on what edition of the game you're looking at, he was Vecna's bodyguard, his general, an assassin, or Vecna's partner. You know, depends on what you're looking at. He was also variously a vampire when he first worked for Vecna, got turned into a vampire while he was working for Vecna, or became a vampire after he betrayed Vecna? He has also been accidentally turned into a vampire by spending too much time in the negative energy plane, because he was cursed, or because Vecna used an artifact called the Mask of Cass on him? This is very confusing. Cass's backstory has been changed so often that he qualifies for a walk-on part in DC Comics' next continuity reboot. Now that makes perfect sense. Give me a little bit of that crisis action.
That was your bit of knowledge from the Bardic College. Now it's time for the Campaign Journal.
I've played 2 D&D games in the past 2 weeks since we last recorded. One of them is Jared's game, which he will be talking about. The other is I got to play my buddy Scott's Cygnus de Gur game. We ended up recapping what had happened last time, which was mostly arriving at this town, kind of investigating, finding out what was going on, because we have this cursed artifact that has been leading us here, and we kind of need to follow this through. And we're pretty sure we needed to go down into this, we don't know if it's catacombs, an old fortress, something that they've been trying to excavate stuff out of. So we knew that's what we were doing. We just needed to figure out how we were getting in there. And there were a couple of different approaches. There was possibly some sort of back entrance or climbing down a deep shaft or kicking down the front door. Or we heard there might be an underground water source. We're like, oh, that sounds interesting. And it was kind of funny because we were debating this and we have a player who is playing a Grung, which is a frog person. And he's like, yes, let's do the underground water thing because we're in the middle of a desert. He's a frog. He basically has rigged up a decanter of endless water under his hat to keep him moist in the desert. So the idea of being able to go through this underwater passage was like, ooh, ooh, yes, please, yes, please. And then I spoke up. I'm like, hey, I have a potion of breathing underwater. we can totally use that. At which point, like, one person started arguing with me, oh, we don't want to use your potion. We don't want to waste your potion. And I'm like, this is like the goddamn video game where you go through the entire game and never use any of your resources, and you end the game having beat the final boss, and you still have every single potion you've collected along the way. Please let me use my potion. At which point our warlock piped up that he actually had the ritual that would let us do breathe underwater and cover the whole party for 24 hours rather than just the hour the potion would do. So it's like, okay, we still did the thing, but I'm like, come on, let me use my potion. I never get to use my potion. And we had this whole long conversation about the passage underwater was a bit difficult, so it would have required some rolls, but we had been smart about it, and we had a natural-born swimmer who was able to go through it no problem. We tied a rope. I took off. My character, Selena, is the fighter. She's in plate mail. Took off the armor, stowed it in the bag of holding. Now, I was perfectly fine going into the next fight without the armor because, you know, fight happens when we come out of the passageway. But no. One of the other players was like, no, we're going to pause here and take a moment so you can put your armor back on. I'm like, oh, okay, fine. Because when it comes down to it, Selena has what I call Pathfinder levels of armor class. She has a 25 AC, which is almost unheard of in 5th edition D&D. It is really, really hard for the bad guys to hit her, which is a lot of fun for me, but I know it can be really frustrating for the GM. So I was going to throw him this bone, but the players are like, no, we want you to have your armor on. We come out into the chamber, and there is a pair of Myconoid shaman there. Basically, big, large mushroom people. And fight starts, causes a bit of a ruckus. Bryn, our sorcerer, cast Daylight, which they didn't like, so one of them tried to run away. We killed the one and then followed the other and realized they had apparently been barricaded into this room because he couldn't go any further. So we dealt with him there and then examined the room we were in, which sometimes when you're running a pre-written adventure, you'll discover things that don't make any sense that your players pick up on.
Mm-hmm.
The way this room was described is that it was a kind of a garden conservatory that had been taken over by mushrooms. But there were signs that there had been normal plants there at one point, and we're like, where did the light come from? And the GM was trying to come up with, there was a whole, you know, skylight and it got buried. And, oh, wait, that wouldn't work because there's stuff on the map above this. And we finally, like, saved him by going, wizards did it. Which was like, okay, we're going to step past that. But I will tell you as a GM, when your players find these things, sometimes they just stick to it like glue.
Yeah.
And make your life a living hell because you need to come up with some reasonable explanation about why this thing is there when all you want to do is get to the next scene.
It was a magic grow light, okay?
We snuck around a little bit, kind of investigating things, and we realized we were kind of on the bottom level of this temple or whatever it was they were excavating. We went up a level and found a kind of a secret meeting room that had some plans on it about what they were trying to do, written in thieves' cant. Luckily, we had a rogue who could kind of read it and understood a little bit what was going on. Went down a secret passage, overheard a conversation between the sister of the town's mayor and her underlings, who basically we'd caused a commotion with the Myconid fight. She was just telling them, I don't care, get back to work. If they're not doing anything, if they haven't broken out, we're fine, get back to work. And then we tried chasing her, you know, we're following her down another passageway, and we arrived in a room, and there were two of her sitting at a table playing cards. And we're like, what the hell? Well, a fight ensued. We barricaded the other door to that room, because we don't want anybody busting in, and we could hear people outside of it. We were causing a commotion. We knocked both of them out. We're pretty sure they're doppelgangers, but because we knocked them out and didn't kill them, we don't know for sure, because they still look like the sister. So that's kind of where we left things. I ended up having a conversation with the GM about this afterward, Like, first of all, we had a debate about whether this sister, is she an actual bad guy? Is she tied up in a cell somewhere mm-hmm. and the doppelgangers are impersonating her? Is she under some sort of mind control? Has she been tricked? The GM and I having a conversation kind of after the game, he's like, sometimes a bitch is just a bitch. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, but I need some sort of sign that this is what the case is, because we don't have enough information to know that she's just a bad guy.
Yeah, I have been in that dilemma before, too, where it's like, I don't want to do the whole it's what my character would do, but also it doesn't feel right to just assume that I know something that we haven't seen any evidence of whatsoever.
Yeah. And like, I figure Selena at this point is pretty convinced that they're doppelgangers, but I don't know that Selena would just outright murder one of them to find out. So I need a sign. And it's not that I want one of the more mercenary characters to just take a knife to the doppelganger's throat and prove that it's a doppelganger. I don't want that either. I need a little more information here, and I'm not sure where that information is.
I get it. I understand. What's funny is when you were talking about the Grung and being excited about the water passageway, that just reminded me of the first Suicide Squad movie when Killer Croc is in this thing the whole time. And it's like, I have no idea why he's on this team. And then all of a sudden there's like, there's this thing that someone needs to swim down to. Oh, that's why Killer Croc was on the team. This thing that somebody needed to swim down to that none of them knew was there in the first place.
You know, oddly enough, my go-to for that is the very old disaster movie from the 70s, Poseidon Adventure, where there's one character, she's an older lady, Shelley
Winters?
Yes, Shelley Winters, well-known decorated actress from the 40s, 50s, 60s. This was like one of her last films. And she's playing this woman, and they're at a point where the Poseidon Adventure, for those who are wondering, is this disaster movie about an ocean cruise liner that gets flipped upside down. And everyone needs to basically make their way from the top first class levels of the ship up to the hull and cut their way out, because that's their only way to save themselves. It's this group of people, and she's like, I was a medal winning swimmer when I was in high school. I can do this. And so she swims in this one point to get them to another location and ends up having a heart attack or something afterwards. But it was still just like that scene has stuck with me. So yeah, if there's a character that can swim, let them swim.
Oh, goodness. The other thing I was going to say is at some point, I really want to see a computer RPG have an achievement for not using any consumables at all throughout the entire course of the game. Just wanted to make sure I didn't need it for something. Final boss fight, you drink 78 potions. So speaking of shape changers, our game, all of the PCs had to travel to Yrazaza's lair. And she wanted to tell them about a secret mission that she was going to send them on. And she was very cagey about even mentioning the full details even within her sanctum. But the PCs kind of picked out that they're going to be going to the same location where the Sultana in exile from the Marodi Empire is currently at. I'm sure that has nothing to do with anything, because that would be treason and nobody would be, you know, thinking of doing that.
Why would we do that?
So after Yrazaza asks Marin to set up his cousin to ship them into this area, you know, surreptitiously, everyone's getting ready to go. Ambassador Darius escorts them down and is acting a little bit strange.
He's actually been acting a little strange for a while, which you have been noting. It's just there were enough momentous things going on that I think we wrote it off as us finally pushing past his levels of decorum.
Yes, and he follows them down, which normally he doesn't do as they are leaving Yrazaza's lair, and three of their friends are there to meet them as well, which is very strange. I had everyone tell me if they successfully made their insight check to figure out that these weren't their friends, what the tell was that person gave them, that they could pick this out. That was kind of fun, but I can't remember any good examples right now, but it was fun in the moment.
I think I said our ranger friend didn't have his Drake with him.
Oh, yeah, that was a big one right there, because he's a Drake warden, so he always has the Drake with him.
I think Ivy's friend was talking a lot more formally than he does.
Yeah, Harold was a lot more calm. So they pick up on this, therefore they were not surprised. And as it turns out, Ambassador Darius is actually a Nol Blood Mage, which was a character that was captured a few months ago in the campaign. The three friends of theirs were actually Oni. Then this fight ensues. Also, you haven't learned this yet, but it's not a big secret. Basically, the Blood Mage, once he got some of Darius's blood, he could switch bodies with him. But they get into this fight. Unfortunately, the Blood Mage was rolling terribly, so even though he was very scary and icky, he did absolutely nothing except teleport away from people beating up on him, and then they caught up to him and beat him up some more.
We did discover the squirrel is vulnerable to cold.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the squirrel got caught in a crossfire between two different cones of cold and went down hard.
I mean, he's not actually vulnerable. It's just constitution saves were not his thing.
Definitely not. The other thing that was funny is the Ratatosk Bard was very pleased to summon a fire elemental. And unfortunately, when you lose concentration on a summoned elemental, going back to like the old school roots, this is what the spell used to do way back in first edition. If you get knocked out or lose concentration, the elemental doesn't disappear. It just goes berserk. So our squirrel kind of took a nap, very cold nap, and was revived. Unfortunately, the elemental was no longer under his control. What was funny about that was it was not out of control long enough for anyone to notice because he got back up when he was healed and immediately dispelled it. By the time they took out all of the Oni, one of the Oni that was still standing said, "I really have no reason to keep fighting you. Can I take my friends and go? I'll tell you, you know, where your friends are at." That's essentially when they found out these Oni are a troop of actors who take side jobs as spies and assassins.
It sounded like they actually started as spies and assassins who were posing as actors.
Yes.
And found out they liked being actors more than they liked being spies and assassins.
Yes, that is exactly how it worked out. So the Oni picks up his friends and let the party know that their friends are all hidden in the old Temple of Nethus that has been boarded up in the religious quarter, that they were specifically told to rile up the humble knights of Searing Truth, who are the very zealous, only draconic religions should be practiced in Moraea type order of paladins that have been just looking for an excuse to burn down the foreign religious quarter. Once they found out that they've been riled up and that their friends are trapped in this old Temple of Nethus, they decided they probably need to head that direction, and that's where we stop for the night.
Should pretty much pick up right with the action, but it'll be interesting to see how we deal with humble knights of Searing Truth. Because they're jerks.
They are, and they've been a thorn in your side for a good portion of the campaign.
And now it's time for the GM's Workshop with Angie and Jared. Let's see if we can't fix up something about our games.
We're going to talk about virtual tabletops, or VTTs. They have become a ubiquitous facet of modern role-playing games. We covered VTTs way back in episode 7, but we thought it was a topic worth revisiting because both of us have been doing a lot more in VTTs and exploring different VTTs since then. So that was more of an overview of what VTTs are. This is going to look a little bit more specifically on our personal experiences since that time. Let's briefly touch on our history of VTTs. What made you try a VTT in the first place?
My first experience with a VTT is way back in like 2003. Maybe 2002, I had made some friends in EverQuest, and we decided we wanted to play D&D together because third edition had come out. We were not living in the same geographic location. I was where I live in Western New York. They were all in Massachusetts, and I think the one girl was in California or Virginia. I don't remember where she was. I just know she was someplace else. So we're like, okay, we'll play on this site, which I can't remember the name of it, but there was no video, there was no voice. It was basically a map space, a character sheet, and typing text. And we typed at each other to play D&D, and it was amazing. I love the character I had in that game. We told some great stories. I've a couple of years ago, got back in touch with the GM from that game, and we've talked about it, and it's still one of his all-time favorite campaigns. but it was this very, very basic, rudimentary VTT of sorts. In more modern times, I started attending conventions more heavily in 2006, 2007 time period, and I started collecting people. I sound like a serial killer there, but I made friends. Somewhere around 2013, I got invited into the quote-unquote Farscape Invitational, which was my friend Ed would run Farscape on Saturdays, and he had a specific group of people he would invite to that game. And I got invited to join that game and play as Chiana. And it was great. And we did this 2013, 2014, and I think around 2015, or maybe it was 2016. It was 2016. He ended the Origins game on a cliffhanger. Like, there is no way this is going to stand. So we ended up getting together later in the summer at one of the players' house in Ohio, and we played, and it was a lot of fun. And it was kind of after that we started talking about playing together online. And at the same time, my friend Jen wanted to start running 5th edition D&D. And so she started running online. And this was these two groups. It was my simultaneous introduction to Roll20. That was kind of my first foray into modern VTTs.
What's really funny is my first foray was generally out of curiosity and ended completely unsuccessfully because I was poking around seeing what different things could do because I was all excited because people were talking about these things and saying, hey, you can play D&D online. And if you can't find anybody, you can't find a campaign, you can just find these people and find the space to play with. And I started engaging with some of them and going, I don't know that I can do this and play D&D at the same time. It felt like it was a lot.
Yeah.
What ended up happening was COVID is what kind of kicked my butt into actually learning how to use VTTs. And that was after a lot of my friends had already adopted using them. It was very interesting because I ran two different D&D games online with my friends without using a VTT. One was finishing up the Tales of the Old Margrave anthology, and one was playing Storm King's Thunder. But because I know you can play Theater of the Mind, and no one is wrong for doing that, I always feel a little unfair if I say something like, I'm just going to assume all of you were in the blast radius of this thing. So to some extent, I was nerfing myself because I would never assume things like that. And I was like, some of these fights did not go the way I wanted them to because of that.
It's probably a whole other topic to get into on map versus theater of the mind. But I found people I would not play D&D with because they would screw over the players in theater of the mind.
Yeah.
Like, I'm playing a rogue. I want to get in backstab position. Oh, no, there's no possible way you can get into backstab position here. And I'm like, I don't know that for sure because it's theater of the mind because you think maps are plebeian and beneath you, so we must play theater of the mind because you are a superior gamer.
That's all right. No, but what was funny about those campaigns is I would have a map next to me and I would have tokens on that map, so I would be moving them, and every once in a while I would like take a picture and send it to somebody and say, does this look right for where everybody's at? Not every round, but just like every once in a while, especially like if I was about to hit everybody with a dragon's breath weapon or something. I was like, this is where I think you were at from how you were describing things. And it was just for me to feel a little bit better. But, you know, the more I'm doing that sort of thing, the more I'm thinking there has to be a better way for me to be doing this if I'm going to be running games online like this for a long period of time. And that's what kind of got me into looking at things a little bit more in depth and forcing myself to learn things. So thinking back to those early days, what were your thoughts about your first forays into playing online?
The original game I talk about with my EverQuest friends, that was amazingly magical because I hadn't played a traditional RPG in probably 7 years. Somewhere in the mid-90s, I've never really been able to pin down when it was. Might have been 94, might have been 95. The group of people I played with stopped playing in person. It was a variety of reasons I don't really need to get into here, but we stopped playing. I started getting my fix in playing on Mushes online, which were purely text-based. And while some of them were based on actual RPGs, like there were a ton of Vampire World of Darkness games out there. And Shadowrun. I played Shadowrun on a mush. It wasn't the same thing. It was still mostly social scene writing together with a little bit of the mechanics thrown in here or there. But it was still mostly just scene writing with our OPs from these games. The Gen Zs get it. They all know it. They do this type of thing. And like when I found out about it, I'm like, oh, you guys are just doing text-based role-playing. And they're like, yeah, we're role-playing. I'm like, you are. It's just, we called it a separate thing. Anyway, it wasn't the same. And then I drifted away from that into EverQuest, which was, sure, I was getting the combat and the excitement of like actual mechanical being a badass in combat, but it wasn't the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to get back to role-playing games was like, oh, this is fun. And that kind of is what spurred me to find an in-person group again and start getting back into role-playing games, realizing as much as I love my friends I played with in the 90s, I need to move on if I want to keep playing role-playing games. In the early days of getting into Roll20, I think one of the things you need to understand with getting into any sort of virtual tabletop is there are technical difficulties and there are learning curves to getting comfortable with them. I remember when the pandemic started and my Saturday group switched to playing online, there was a point where, you know, I was setting up a Knights Black Agents game for the group. So we were doing some character creation, we were doing all of this, but I also knew I had to factor in the technical difficulties of getting everyone logged into Roll20, logged into Zoom, their video working, their audio working, all of us able to see each other, all of us able to interact with Roll20. And we were about an hour and 45 minutes into it. We were still working out some of these technical difficulties. And one of the players' wives popped her head into the camera. And she's like, are you guys still not playing yet? And I'm like, it's okay. This is what I expected. You always have to factor in that technical difficulty learning curve of getting everyone up and running.
And honestly, that's what kept me from, especially with Roll20, getting on board with it, because I would understand a bunch of it when I would start watching videos and play around with it. But then I'd be like, but how do you do this? And then it didn't feel that intuitive to me to do that one thing. And then I would worry that in the middle of a game, I'm going to forget how to do this. And then I'm going to shut down and everyone is going to stop having fun and I'm going to ruin it for everybody. So I should never do this. And the only way I can work through stuff like that is to just force myself to go through and do those things and see how likely it is that that thing would actually not happen in the game.
Yeah.
Whenever I look at a task to begin with, I generally assume that it will be insurmountable and that I will be a failure at it. And then I'm pleasantly surprised when I am minimally competent at it.
I know for me, it's usually I'll do the minimal amount of research myself to figure out how to start doing things. And then when I pull my friends into play, and it's always going to be my friends first, I warn them up front, hey, I'm still working out the kinks here.
Mm-hmm.
We're figuring this out together. My friends are great about that. I mean, I totally get the anxiety. You want to make sure it's good. You want to make sure it's right. But there's a technical learning curve to a lot of these.
Well, it's funny because it is dueling anxieties that get me to learn something versus not learning how to do it. But I'll go into that a little bit later. I did want to say, I don't know if this is the one you were talking about, but I was thinking about the very early BTTs that I looked at way back in the day. And I started looking at these probably 2008, 2009, because I was trying to support Pathfinder Society at that point in time. So I was going to see, if I can't make it to any more conventions, maybe at least I can, you know, run some things online, because they started talking about how, oh yeah, it would be legal for you to do this. And one of those things that I looked at was called RP Tools.
I think that might be it, or Map Tools or something like that.
Well, yeah, and I think Map Tools is like a subdivision of that RP Tools site. And it is very interesting, and I could never wrap my head fully around it. But it was basically that, like, you're not talking to anyone, you're typing out messages to each other.
Yeah.
And then seeing the roles come up and things like that. But yeah, that was one of the first things that I looked at, and I wasn't sure if I could get a full handle on that, but Fantasy Grounds has been around forever, and they actually were around not long after that, and that was one of the early ones that I looked at too. The interesting thing is, Fantasy Grounds looks almost exactly the same, except a little bit brighter and shinier and with higher resolution as it did back then.
Yeah, Fantasy Grounds is, it's one of the VTTs I have opinions about. It is very powerful. It has a lot of options. There is not a lot in it that is intuitive.
Yes.
It is designed by software engineers who do not know UX. I will play in it if that's what the GM I want to game with wants to use, but I'm probably going to bitch about it a little bit.
Well, it is funny that you bring it up like that, because I learned a little bit more about how to play it because my friend wanted to run a game with it, and everyone in that game works in some form of IT. And I was just thinking about, like, I don't think I want to use this if I ever want a game with people that aren't in IT.
One of the interesting things is I don't think Fantasy Grounds has ever had video and voice integrated into it, but Roll20 has. It has not been particularly stable.
Yeah.
My understanding is it's gotten a lot better, but I remember in those early days playing in Jen's game, I think we used the video in Roll20, but we would not use the audio.
How have your experiences with VTTs changed over the years?
I didn't start running until I was playing around with Roll20. To be fair, Jen was a very early adopter of Roll20, so she had a lot of knowledge about how to do things, and I learned a lot from her. In the beginning, there was a lot of frustrating trying to figure out, what do I actually need? What should I actually have here? What is important to this game that I am trying to run?
Mm-hmm.
And I would say I would have never tried to run D&D on Roll20 in the past, just because it was way more complicated. It was easy for me to do other games, like some PBTA games on there. Very hesitant of getting into some of the more technical aspects of running on a VTT. In the intervening years, I have explored other VTTs. I learned that Shard has what I want to run D&D. That is my go-to place if I want to run D&D online with folks. It has all the features I want. Basically, I think what has changed is my comfort level and my understanding of what I need and what I want.
That is a very true statement for me as well. By the way, if I have one wish for the wider D&D 5e market anywhere, it would be for Wizards to give Shard an official license so that they are a little bit more robust in what they can offer, because it's a VTT that is specifically made to run 5e. Honestly, I think whenever you're talking about a mechanically robust system, if you have a VTT that is tailored to that, it is always going to be better than a VTT that is trying to facilitate every type of gaming, especially wildly different but also equally robust systems.
Yeah, I would love to see them get an actual license, but thankfully, with the way Shard is set up, is it is not hard to add in what you need to have available for your game.
Mm-hmm.
The nature of the way the SRD works, the way the VTT works, as long as you own the material, as long as you physically have the book on your shelf or have access to the material in D&D Beyond, you are well within your right to put that material into your library on Shard.
Yes. And what's interesting is, we'll get into this probably a little bit more as we're talking about this, but Shard and also Alchemy both let you import characters from D&D Beyond.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they don't have the options that character has, those options, the descriptions of them and everything, and however it's emulated, kind of comes over to that VTT when you import the character.
Yeah, this is honestly how I set up Shard. I made characters in D&D Beyond that had the features that weren't in Shard, and I imported those characters in, which imported those features into my library on Shard. There was some cleanup work I had to do. There were certain species that came through as separate species rather than subspecies.
Yeah.
The Genasi or the Shifters. And since I was running Eberron, I needed to fix those Shifters. Not that any of my players played them, but still.
Just in case.
I wanted to make sure it was all clean.
My history, when I finally got into VTTs, what's really funny is I went all in on Albert Rodeo. Because Albert Rodeo is basically, here is a gridded map and a bunch of tokens that are representative of the different, you know, monster types. So there's like a dragon token, an aberration token, and a humanoid token.
I don't even think there's dice in there, is there?
Yeah, there's a dice. There's a dice okay. function. You know, that was my first thought where I was like, hey, this is all I need. If I have this and I can see where tokens are at least then I'm not saying, hey, I hit all of you with this dragon's breath. I know where everybody's at. I can measure out where things are at. We have this, you know, there's a simple drawing tool. So if I want to say there's a building over here or there's a hole in the ground over here, I can do all of that stuff. And it's really simple. I will still say, if you don't want to engage with a ton of stuff and you're okay with everyone just running their characters off of their own character sheets and you're okay running stuff out of your books, but you want to have a common space, I still say Albert Rodeo is a great place to go for that. It's just a very stable, simple thing.
When they initially started doing the playtesting for the current 2024 version of D&D, we did some playtests of the new material in Albert Rodeo because it was just easier to not have to worry about a VTT having a character sheet tailored to the new information.
I have done this a few times where I just manually type in all of the options that didn't exist. Oh boy, does that take up a lot of time, and Jared gets very obsessive and will keep doing that and spend an entire weekend when he could have been doing other things, just doing stuff like that. Part of what got me, though, into learning more about Roll20 specifically is, one, this is still a weird, hazy thing, but I ended up representing Gnome Stew in a death match that was being televised and run through Roll20, and the weirdest thing about that death match is, I was the only person on Team Gnome Stew that actually writes for Gnome Stew. I don't know who the other people were that were on Team Gnome Stew. It was a very strange thing, but because everybody was like, oh yeah, you should do this, I was like, okay, I'm going to have to kind of learn how this works a little bit. And that's where I was saying anxiety from the other direction can force me to do things that in the anxiety from one direction stops me from doing, because then I'm like, I can't let everyone down. I need to learn exactly how this works. But it also helped that I was learning how it works just from running a character.
Yeah.
Just learning how the character sheet works, learning how the tokens work. I wasn't trying to learn all the functions of what a GM needs to do, but that really did get me into, okay, some of this is not as hard as I thought it was. I've kind of broken the ice. So now I'm going to start pulling things apart in Roll20 and seeing how they work and maybe figuring out how to do this from the GM side of things. It was basically just like, once I saw that, some of the things that it automates and that you have available to you are very handy. And, you know, we'll be touching on that kind of stuff in a little bit, this discussion a little bit later, too. Do you have different opinions on what makes a good VTT between being a player and being a GM?
Some of it is the same, but if I am a player, I want to be able to easily access my character.
Mm-hmm.
I want to have all of the relevant information I need for my character, and I want to be able to push a button to do the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want it to be super complicated. I don't want to have to remember a whole bunch of different things I need to do beforehand. I want to be able to just push the button. But I want my character sheet to be complete. I want it to have all of the information. I don't want to have to keep running back and forth between the character sheet in the VTT and my external PDF or paper copy that I have of the character sheet. For the most part, I want some of the same things as a GM. I want to be able to do stuff without it being super difficult. I want to be able to set things up in a relatively easy, streamlined fashion
mm-hmm.
for the session, so I'm not scrambling to pull things together. I think it's different needs of ease.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I want stuff to be relatively simple so I can focus on having fun and playing my character.
Yeah.
You know, and on, obviously, if I'm the GM, I want stuff to be relatively simple so I can focus on putting the game together mm-hmm. and running it for everyone. But those are different needs. I need more complicated stuff as a GM to set things up. As a player, I don't care about any of that crap.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know where my token is. I want to be able to move my token. I want to have access to my character sheet and know when I go and know how to do the things I want to do.
I completely agree. My main thing as a player, I want the character sheet that is in the VTT to have spots for all the stuff you're supposed to record for that character. And I realize some things have like, oh, this has a notes section or whatever. I want the sheet to have it on there, though. I don't want to have to makeshift write things in history or, you know, in allies or something like that. I want the thing. If there's a section for talents, I want it to have a section for talents, because that way I'm not hunting all over the place trying to remember where I hid something just to make sure it was written down.
And I want it to have a section for more than just the name of the thing. It needs to have enough space for me to put the mechanical description of what that talent does for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not, I have Deadshot. What, I don't know what this does. I go have to find the book to look up what Deadshot does.
Yeah, I agree. And honestly, you're playing online. If you have the book, you can cut and paste. As long as there's enough characters that you can paste the description into it.
Be careful. Cutting and pasting from a PDF can sometimes introduce weird characters, weird carriage returns. You got to be a little careful with the formatting, but that also may just be me, because I'm the one that does a little bit of graphic design, and that stuff annoys the crap out of me.
It's not just you, because there are actual things in Roll20 that the way they're formatted drives me nuts, because they don't split up a paragraph that is split up in the actual rulebook or things like that. And it's like, I will actually open up a character and put that space in there just so that it's two paragraphs and then save it. So it's not just you. The other thing I would say as a player is, if I have something that requires me to roll something that is not just roll this number of dice and add them together, or roll this D20 and add something to it to see if you hit your target number, if there's any like tricky things in there, I want it to help me handle those tricky things.
Yeah.
One of the things I wish Roll20 did is I wish that when you had some of these feats or class abilities that lets you reroll a certain number of dice, that you could do that. I will say that I don't think that's as unreasonable as people might think it is, because you can do that in the Marvel character sheet, in the Marvel Multiverse character sheet. It's just not something that they spent a lot of time implementing in the D&D sheet yet, which may change as they're doing the new version of the character sheet.
Yeah, Roll20 has a lot of flexibility if you know how to do certain things. Even though we on this show primarily talk about D&D, you know that we are polygamerous and we play lots of other games. And many of the character sheets that are available on Roll20 are created by people in the community. They're not created by Roll20 to be used. Some of them are better than others. There's certain games that have multiple character sheets to choose from because they've been made by multiple people. I think Knights Black Agent has like three, and some of them are bad. No offense to whoever created them, but my friend Laura ran Part-Time Gods, second edition Part-Time Gods game for us on Roll20. And that is a game that does dice pools of D10s, and you're looking for a certain number of successes on the dice.
Yeah.
There's not a sheet for that. There was no sheet made for this at the time we started playing this. I'm not sure if there is now. She created a macro that basically just sat at the bottom of the screen for us, and we would hit the number of dice we were rolling, and it would basically tell us how many successes, which was perfect. It's all we needed for that game. But yeah, they have somebody smart enough to know how to program that macro.
Yeah, I know at one point in time this did not exist in there because I looked for it, but there is now a 7C second edition character sheet that does what that game has you do, which is you roll D10s and then you add the number of dice together to equal 10. So you know how many, you know, pairs of those that you get and how many you have left over the GM can use. all of that takes some effort, and it would be great if a character sheet does it, and the character sheet does it reasonably well. It just doesn't do the thing that my players used to do, where there would be shenanigans in how they would assemble their 10 so that they had fewer dice left over. All of these tiny ones go together to make one 10, and so you only have this one left here. That is a whole other thing right there, but if there's any kind of dice rolling thing that gets more complicated, I want it to be able to do that without it being too difficult for me. Speaking of rolling things online, I had a Star Trek game that I ran through Discord right after COVID. We could get the dice to do what we needed them to do because you're rolling multiple D20s and you're looking for rolling under a certain amount, but you had to type in that dice formula whenever you were doing things like that. I could do it, and sometimes I had a few of the formulas just on a piece of paper so I could cut and paste them into Discord, but I would really rather something just did this for me.
I will say Star Trek has a good character sheet in Roll20 now.
Yes.
It's a pretty solid sheet.
Yeah, it was before I got over my fear of Roll20, though. Also, the One Ring Second Edition, I like that sheet once you understand how it works. It's a little quirky when you first start using it, but it handles the die rolls in that game very well once you understand what it's doing.
I think that kind of also leads to there's a conversation to be had, as you were saying, about generic VTTs that are made to run a variety of games and VTTs that are designed to support a specific system. Let's be honest here, the RPG business doesn't actually have a whole lot of money in it.
Yeah.
And creating a VTT requires a fair amount of money, which is why you see a lot more of these general VTTs that kind of work with companies to create plugins for their games.
Yeah.
It's the where are the resources going type of thing.
Oh, yeah. Before I go off on a tangent there, the other thing I was just going to say, as a GM, I really like it when I can look up things in a compendium or rules really quickly. If I can do a search and it pops up, I love that. And I will say, it's not perfect and there's lots of things that are still broken, but there are times it is faster to look things up in Roll20's compendium than to try and get the search function on D&D Beyond to work. D&D Beyond is an amazing site with the worst search, you know, algorithm that I have ever seen.
I mean, half the time, if I go to Google and search 5e blah, it's going to bring up the Roll20 compendium.
Oh, yeah, definitely. From the GM side, that rules lookup thing I really appreciate, because I know that we have been very trained in face-to-face gaming to say, we're going to make a judgment call and we'll look it up after the game. But sometimes I do feel a little bit better when I can just, while the players are busy finishing something else out, just type this thing in and read the paragraph on how it's actually supposed to work and go, that's exactly how it's supposed to work. I remember now.
Theoretically, it should be like type in words, pull up information. Should be quicker than grabbing book, going to index, realizing it doesn't have an index, going to the table of contents, realizing that doesn't help you, and then thumbing through until you find what you're looking for. It should be quicker to just do the search on the website.
Yes.
Hopefully.
There is a thing that I really appreciated when I was playing on Fantasy Grounds as a player that I feel bad because I have not been really great at in my campaigns, and that is using dynamic lighting, because I really did like that idea and that feeling that as long as nobody was moving faster than their movement rate, we could just explore a dungeon at our own pace. I'm going to move 30 feet here, and then this is what I see now because my light source is opening up all of this stuff, and oh crap, there's something in the corner. I really like that, but I have not invested as much in learning how to really play with that dynamic lighting.
I will say my experiences with dynamic lighting are like, I hate it. I hate it. It puts weird shadows on the map. There's weird angles. It's just like, I now can't see the area where I was, you know, even as a reference to remember where I, you know, what I was doing there. I like the idea of dynamic lighting. I have not liked a single implementation I've seen of it.
Part of why I haven't learned it is because I would obsess over getting it just right and potentially doing what you were saying, because there are ways to get previously seen areas to stay visible. but that's not a default when you're using that either. So that's a whole other can of bundles of worms of other creatures.
Yeah.
All shoved together that I don't want to open.
Yeah.
For the things that you've been looking at differently in VTT options, why have we been doing that?
There's something you're going to be mentioning in downtime research that I was looking at, and that had me looking at the Alchemy VTT, because I could possibly get these options in there, and these are all games that I enjoy and could run online. And so I was poking a little bit at Alchemy, which it looks very shiny. It's not a huge financial investment, but it is some money to get both the assets and the account on Alchemy to have access to all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided not to, but that's partly why I was looking at it. And I have considered Foundry is very interesting, and I have played some games on it, and it seems like it's very powerful for a wider variety of games.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's a financial investment.
Yeah.
It is very easy to end up putting your money everywhere.
Yes.
Because there are subscription accounts for these VTTs. There is stuff to purchase on the VTTs, so you have access to material. It could be very easy to overspend on stuff. And I am trying to be good with my money.
Yeah.
Because I am having to replace my furnace and my air conditioning unit. I have been without AC since the end of June. This has not been fun. Anyway, I try and be good about my money in general. And it is very easy to end up overspending on VTTs. You have to figure out where you want to invest your time and your money.
Oh, yeah. What was the Roll20 owned one that went under kind of before everything started consolidating, the VTT?
Astral.
Yes. What is interesting to me about Alchemy is that it reminds me of One Bookshelf's old VTT that they had going, Astral, which kind of folded, but it folded not long before Roll20 bought them.
Yeah.
Which made it kind of obvious that they weren't going to keep supporting a separate VTT like that. But the reason I say that is there were some neat things you could do in Astral, like making it rain or changing what time of day it was on a map, that were kind of built into the system. And Alchemy seems like it has some of that stuff going on too.
Astral had the one set of dynamic lighting I didn't hate.
Mm-hmm.
It was built in that as you explored an area, the areas you didn't have lighting for were shaded,
mm-hmm.
but they weren't blacked out.
Yeah.
So you didn't get the weird shadows. You just got the, you are in this area. This is where you have light. That area is now dark. Astral was shooting above its weight class.
Yeah.
It was trying to do a lot, but it didn't really have the resources to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the character sheets were crap. There was no good D&D character sheet. You had to craft the whole thing. So we would basically just make macros in the character sheet to roll the things we needed to roll.
Yeah, I remember I played around with the Star Trek Adventures and Octane Cthulhu 2D20 because they had starter adventures on that platform. And yeah, the character sheet was not an intuitive process. It was not nice.
As far as it, you know, the map goes and the lighting goes, it was very robust.
Oh yeah.
Scott was able to pull in the entirety of the first level of the Dungeon of the Mad Mage,
mm-hmm.
which, if you know anything about it, it's massive.
Yeah.
There, you couldn't do that on Roll20.
Yeah.
You can't even really do it on Shard. I wouldn't recommend doing it on most VTTs, mm-hmm. but it was very easy to do and move around and drag your player's sight to where they needed to be. It's just the character sheet was crap. I think they're trying to be fancier than they could really afford to be because they just didn't have the financial bandwidth to support what they were trying to do.
It's funny because it feels like we're going that direction again now, but there was a point in time when there was just this proliferation of VTTs, and then it seemed like it started to contract a little bit again, and now it seems like it's starting to expand out again. But I mean, you know, when we're talking about looking at different options, I have always liked Shard. It's just that I own too much stuff on Roll20, and I also want to have my official D&D stuff interact with my third party stuff, which is harder to do on Shard. Now, the reason I am now looking at Shard, though, is I want to play Tales of the Valiant, and I want to give it a test run just using Tales of the Valiant material. And the problem is, Roll20 has not started implementing Tales of the Valiant yet. I paid for that during the Kickstarter, so someday, when they get back around to implementing it, I might have it. But right now, I don't.
But it's on Shard.
Yes, Shard has Tales of the Valiant completely in there. The player's guide is in there. The monster vault is in there. And the other thing, when Ange was talking about how much money it takes to invest in things, there is a subscription service for Kobold Press material on Shard. It's not no money, but the player subscription is $3.99 a month, and the Game Master subscription is $6.99 a month. And that's basically getting you everything they have put out for players options and everything they've put out for GM's options, both the 5e SRD stuff and the new Tales of the Valiant stuff. That's a lot easier for me to do than trying to rebuy everything that I own of Kobold Presses on a new VTT. Now, granted, as soon as I quit, you know, paying for that subscription, I lose all of that, and I get it, but it at least gets me in the door to try and play with this and have this whole range of stuff that I have everywhere else at my fingertips for that.
Let's be honest, campaigns don't last forever, and that's not an insurmountable subscription fee to pay while you are running a campaign using that material.
Oh yeah, definitely. And the other thing that I will say, I have not gotten a chance to run anything through Shard yet, but I have put together a campaign and added, you know, modules in and things like that. You can use all of the 5e stuff very easily with the Tales of the Valiant stuff. Now, you can't have a character that uses, say, talents and feats, but you can have a red dragon from the SRD and a green dragon from the Monster Vault in the same encounter. All that stuff works fine. You can pull spells from wherever you want to. So all of that stuff that isn't like a structural thing works fine swapping out different modules between those two things. So I'm really kind of excited to play around with that. What is the main difference between prepping for an in-person game and prepping for something on a VTT?
Prepping the encounters in the VTT and prepping the encounters in my folder with the stuff I need. I'm a lot more particular about the maps when I'm prepping for something online. Whereas if I'm prepping to run it in person, I have a handy dandy Chessex map, which I can just pull out my wet erase markers and draw the thing on the map for my players, and we're good to go. I do a little bit of fussing with minis and tokens to play in person, but it's a little different than what I do for a VTT. Now, one thing to understand about me and VTTs is that I have an artistic graphic design background, so I am very particular about the images and the way things look.
Mm-hmm.
So I will spend a great deal of time fussing about putting that together in the VTT. Whereas if I'm running in person, all that fussing is going into my notes that are going to be right in front of me. When I was running the Depths of Zendrick campaign, we played in person, I think, twice. We never get to as much material as I have already prepped in the VTT, which means I always have a little bit of a buffer. But when we switch from playing in the VTT to playing in person, that means I now have these really cool maps that are in the VTT that I can't show to the players because we're playing in person. In a couple of cases, I actually printed out maps.
Mm-hmm.
I got access to a large format printer and printed out the maps so I could put them in front of my players. I also tried, in one of the sessions, I tried having Shard up on my laptop and doing all of my rolling in the VTT while the players were interacting with the map on the table. I gave myself a headache. I wear glasses.
Mm-hmm.
They're bifocals. I'm old. I deal with it. But this means that if I'm usually working on a close digital surface, like a tablet or a laptop that's right in front of me, I need to take off my glasses.
Mm-hmm.
but then I have to look up and look at the table in front of me, which means I need to put my glasses on.
Yeah.
Or I'm trying to look between the bifocal. It gave me a headache.
Mm-hmm.
So the next time I ran, I basically still had everything set up in Shard, but I still printed out all my stats, and I didn't use the dice in the VTT anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of where are your notes and how much detail do you need to put in those notes?
Yeah. For me, it varies greatly depending on what phase I am in about running a game in person, because when I was trying to use actual miniatures to represent things, it would drive me absolutely up the wall when I didn't have the right miniatures to represent something or even like vaguely close to it. I hated using the wrong mini for things. That is a me thing. I am not saying that is good. That is not a healthy idea to have, but it is something I could not get beyond. Yeah, I used to literally order bundles of miniatures from Miniature Market, like single loose ones for encounters, and hope they got here before my next session. I don't suggest you do that.
What's funny is that when I ran one of the Depths of Zendrix campaigns in person, I knew that I wanted a corpse flower in the game. They had done a set of minis, D&D minis, that had a corpse flower as a rare option in one of the boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And my buddy Doug, out of habit, always buys one case
mm-hmm.
of D&D minis. So he brought me that case, and I went through 9 boxes looking for this damn mini that ended up being in the very last one.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like, this shouldn't be that hard to find. There should be one of these in here.
Statistically speaking, there should be one here.
And as a result, I keep this mini, the corpse flower, on my desk. I'm actually showing it to Jared right this second.
What was much healthier for me was I found these dry erase tokens. I started just writing the name of things on these tokens and putting them on the map. And it was like, this is so much better because nobody looks like they're supposed to. They're just tokens on a map. I'm good now.
I did find a crafty way to do this. This is still a little bit of a financial investment because you need to buy 1-inch washers. You need to buy the clear plastic sticker epoxy cover, and you need to be able to print out the images you want on your tokens. And you need to have some glue sticks. So it's like you print the thing out, you cut it out, you glue it onto the washer, and then you put the clear epoxy thing over the top. They feel really fancy for something that's kind of cheap and DIY, but they look really good.
I did something similar. I found the glass tile things that you do for like crafts
mm-hmm.
that were about 1 inch by 1 inch. I was using those and gluing pictures onto those. And that was kind of neat too, but also time intensive. I guess what I'm saying overall, though, is, for example, if I'm running face-to-face, I don't like looking through books all the time. So if I'm going to be using monsters and I know there's monsters coming up, I usually printed out those pages. So just those monsters that I know will be showing up are right here. If I was running an adventure and they were in a dungeon, I would print out that level of the dungeon and have that there. And part of me felt really bad because I hated making these copies of things that I'm going to use for one game session. And then that's it. And I keep printing these things out, and I'm using paper and I'm using ink, but it was something that I did a lot when I was running face to face. Now, running on VTT now, one of the big problems, for example, when I would run face to face, I would get mad because, like, let's say I want to throw 6 frost giants at someone. No one has 6 frost giant miniatures. You can't even find 6 frost giant miniatures to buy from places like Miniature Market because they're usually either ridiculously overpriced for, you know, being a single figure, or they don't have 6 in stock. When you're running online, you got 6 miniatures. You got 6 tokens of frost giants right there. They can be frost giants. I like all of that thing. I like my notes for our game. Every session, I have the bullet points for the adventure in handouts that I have. And as you finish adventures, I just put them in a folder, and if I ever need to look back on them, I can open up that folder and look and see what was in those. That's really handy, too. I like that I can create handouts from different games. Like, there are certain game rules that you can turn into a handout and share with the players. So it's not even like you have to share the Dungeon Master's Guide. You can share this one optional rule that is about this one thing and turn it into a handout and share it with the player characters, and then they have that active for them. I'm kind of spoiled a little bit with how I prep things in VTTs now versus face-to-face.
Oh, yeah. And one of the things that's nice, and I'm going to steal this one from you, is that if you have to end the session, everything is still right there.
Oh, yeah.
We had to end the Scott's D&D game with us in the room with the two unconscious duplicates of the sister. And we don't need to worry about where we left things. We don't need to worry about him redrawing the maps. We don't need to worry about him trying to remember where the other NPCs are. Everything is still sitting there waiting for us.
I remember taking pictures of maps so that we remembered where everything was at if we ended on a cliffhanger. And it actually disincentivized me from ending things on a cliffhanger sometimes. And I like doing that. So I like just being able to say, okay, we're done. We're just not touching the map now until we play again. And, you know, that's great from a VTT perspective. I will say I feel bad because I don't have your problem. And this is something I've noticed since I've been running for my daughter and my daughter-in-law and their group. I can have Curse of Strahd up in Roll20 on my laptop and run the game out of that. That is so much easier than me flipping through books to do it.
Yeah, it's a really nice thing if you can do it. I just, with my vision, I couldn't do it. It gave me a headache.
And there are things that I miss not running face-to-face. There is a certain energy that no matter how great your friends are and no matter how engaged everybody is, it is a different energy than when you're playing face-to-face with people.
One, I miss my dice.
Mm-hmm.
I miss my shiny goblin math rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a degree of social interaction that you can't have running online that you get playing in person.
Yeah.
And basically it's crosstalk, table talk. It's very hard to do that without stepping all over each other.
Yeah.
Online, on a VTT, using Zoom, using Discord, using Google Meet, whatever it is you're using, it's very hard to have those like little side conversations between you and another player. You kind of have to wait for your turn to speak.
Yeah.
And that's all great, polite online courtesy. There's a little bit different when you're playing in person.
Yeah.
On a personal level, one of the things I have noticed is if I'm playing, this is not if I'm a GM, if I am playing, there are times where I need to pull up on my tablet or my phone a small game of like match three or a puzzle where I'm like just putting a puzzle together, because if I don't have something to do with my hands while sitting here in front of the computer, I start getting fidgety and I will lose focus on the game.
Yeah.
Whereas if I can have my hands doing something, I'm fully paying attention to the game.
Yeah.
I don't need to do that in person. If I'm at the table in person with everyone, I never reach for the phone to play a game. I never reach for the tablet to play a game. I'm fully invested in being there with everyone at the table. It's this weird change in the way my brain works that I need to do that if I'm playing online so I can keep concentrating on the game.
Someday we're going to get ambitious enough to actually do this topic because we have it on our list about accommodating different people. But that is an interesting thing because some people, when they play around on a tablet or their phone, they're not paying attention. But some people have to do that to focus, especially if you have people that are neurodivergent at your table. Sometimes they need to have more than one thing going so that they can focus on one thing.
Yeah.
It is interesting. Sometimes we assume things that are not true for everyone.
Yeah. I have never been one of the people that says no phones at the table,
mm-hmm.
no devices at the table. I've never been like that. But ever since the dawn of the pandemic and the need to play online exclusively or more often, I've realized that aspect of my brain, so I've been a lot more forgiving of it as long as the player is still engaging in the game
mm-hmm.
and isn't like, doesn't have to be reminded that it's their turn or like,
yeah.
It's very quickly obvious who is paying attention and not.
Yeah.
And if I start getting somebody giving me a little bit of a side eye, because it's obviously I'm doing something on my tablet, I'll just let them know, I need this so I can focus, because otherwise my hand is going to drift to that mouse and suddenly I'm on Facebook. And I'm not paying attention to you.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm doing this, I'm listening to everything that's going on in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when it's my turn, I know who's going on, I'm contributing. It's just one of those things.
I've had multiple convention sessions where someone will like knit at the table while they're playing.
Yes.
They are some of the best players that I've had at a table. So, I mean, it's not really a distraction. It's just them doing something additional to keep their mind engaged.
I have two artists in my gaming group. And when we play in person, they are usually drawing together on their tablets
mm-hmm.
or on paper. It is like they are still always engaged in the game. Their heads are down. They're doodling in the you mm-hmm. know, whatever they're drawing on, but they are still fully engaged in the game.
Someday we'll probably talk about something beyond just the accommodating players, but also like taking notes. And one of the reasons I take so many notes in your game is because me taking notes helps me focus on the game. And it's not your GMing. It's not anyone else in the game. I am ADHD and autistic. It doesn't, you know, I don't just pay attention to things normally. So I need that extra emphasis to be able to split my focus so that I can focus, which doesn't make any sense, but you know, neither does my brain.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is interesting. I will say, to wrap this all up and bring it back to what we were saying before, prepping and running games on a VTT has changed how I prep and run games in person, because I have seen some of that, you know, versatility and some of the tools that I can get in that, and still hybridize that with having an actual map and actual tokens and being able to roll real dice and have people in the same space as me. So it is a very interesting thing to go from, I can't do this at all, to, I want to do this even when I'm doing this face to face.
Now let's join Ange and Jared for some downtime research, where they do the work so we don't have to.
Every episode, we're going to look for something related to D&D that we want to pass along to our listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, podcasts, but it will always be something that we think will enhance your D&D experience. But first up, we wanted to share that we now have a Patreon for the show. Supporting us through the Patreon will help us keep making the best show possible and give us the chance to share with you a whole bunch of other D&D-related content. If you've got the bandwidth to support us, check it out over at patreon.com/thackzerowa. So that's THACZERO WA. And we'll be really grateful. And eventually we're going to start naming our patrons on the show, and it's going to be nice, and it's really cool stuff. And yeah, we like doing this. Help us do it.
And we have stuff we want to share with you. And we were so excited about this. Ange put that blurb in at the beginning of this segment, and I put that blurb in at the end of the segment, because we really wanted to make sure someone told you to look at our Patreon.
The other thing I'm going to give a shout out to is, if you are considering going to Gamehole Con, and you should consider going to Gamehole Con, if you go to cons and you can make it to Madison, Wisconsin, they will be opening event registration on August 31st. Gamehole is a 4-day con that goes from October 17th through October 20th. I was able to go last year and it was a great time. And so I'm hoping to go again this year. And they actually have a fair amount of Tales of the Valiant on the schedule, as well as plenty of other games. So check it out. We'll have a link to their website on the in the show notes.
I haven't been there post-pandemic, but I really love Gamehole Con. It is like one of my favorite cons that I've ever been to. So someday I will get back to it.
Hopefully next year we can get you to Gamehole.
It's what I'm going to try and shoot for. What I thought I would mention is the Free League Immersive RPG Bundle for Alchemy VTT that is on Humble Bundle.
Oh, hey, that's a thing. I run a lot of games in Free League games.
Yeah, that may have been what Ange was talking about earlier that got her looking at Alchemy. The reason I'm bringing this up for our D&D listeners is that there are so many things that Free League has done that are in this bundle. But one of the things that is in there is the Runes of Simbarum, the campaign setting guide and the adventure anthologies and the player's guide and the monster book. That's all in this bundle. You can get pretty much the entire line of Runes of Simbarum, which is the 5e version of the Simbarum setting, which is also a separate game system as well. But the whole 5e implementation is part of this, as well as the core Simbarum game that has the original system. If you're going to look beyond 5e, but you're still looking at fantasy games, there is a ton of Forbidden Lands products that are in there. the Dragonbane core set and Bestiary are in there. I think it's going to be like 9 days or so by the time this episode drops that you'll still have to look at that. So I think that would be a cool thing to check out for everybody.
In Dragonbane, you can play a duck person.
You can. We are happily part of the Polygamerus Podcast Network, helping you run and play your best games. We think you'll enjoy another Polygamerus podcast like...
The Gnomecast. Several gnomes from Gnome Stew get together and talk about gaming topics and themselves in an effort to entertain you and avoid being thrown in the stew.
That sounds familiar. Like, don't we know someone that's on that show?
We might know somebody who does that show a lot. We might know a couple of people that do that show a lot.
It sounds familiar. Anyway, we have used up all of our resources, so I think it's time for a long rest. I hope this adventure was rewarding for you. We hope you'll go exploring with us when we start our next adventure.